We have some major new material to begin. Most of what we've been considering in the term up to now can come under the heading of the dependence of the division of labor on the institutions of capitalism, and that includes all of our discussion of price theory. The division of labor depends on the price system, and I think that I've shown that the price system in turn depends on the existence of capitalism, specifically the profit motive and private ownership of the means of production as the foundations of the price system. Now, tonight and also next week, we're going to be going into the reciprocal influence of the division of labor back on some of the major institutions of capitalism. And we'll be dealing with three leading institutions: private ownership of the means of production, economic inequality, and economic competition. We'll deal with economic inequality and economic competition next week. Tonight, it's private ownership of the means of production. And closely related to that, the influence of the division of labor on the institution of inheritance. Once we've dealt with private ownership of the means of production in the light of the difference a division of labor makes, we'll be able to look at the issue of inheritance and also inheritance taxes in a very different light than is customary. And we'll be able to look at the entire subject of taxation in a different light than most people do it. Such major current issues as tax cuts for the rich versus the poor or the middle class. And then, hopefully, time permitting, we'll deal with the special case of private ownership of land and natural resources. And finally, implications for private property and political sovereignty. There's an important parallel in what we'll point out about private property and who benefits from it, and implications for the extent of sovereignty. All right, let me turn now to private ownership of the means of production. And I think there's a widely prevailing view on the subject, which is that private property, including private ownership of the means of production, serves the interests only of its owners. That the only people who benefit from the privately owned means of production are the businessmen and capitalists who own the means of production. I think this is what's generally taken for granted. And it's on the basis of that assumption that so many people believe that there is something to be gained by a policy of redistribution of wealth or socialism. You see, if one believes that the only people who gain from the privately owned means of production are the owners, well, then what is required for someone who's presently a non-owner ever to be in a position to gain from those means of production?
Yeah?
Have to be an owner.
He would have to become their owner. So it appears that there might be some interest on the part of people in confiscating other people's property. So long as the property is the property of others, those others benefit, but not the non-owners. That's the prevailing thinking. In order for the non-owners first to benefit, they would have to become owners. And this point of view shows up in a variety of ways. I would be surprised if you never had the experience in your lifetime of having been in a conversation or discussion or some kind of argument where someone is propounding a relatively pro-free enterprise position, and he comes up against an argument or an innuendo sometimes that if he's in favor of a pro-free enterprise position, he personally must be a capitalist. He must be an owner of means of production. You can be arguing a certain point of view, and after being heard for a little while, if what you're arguing for is lower corporate taxes or reducing the income tax on the upper brackets or the inheritance tax or whatever, it's very, very likely that you'll come up against the accusation, well, you must be pretty rich, you must have quite a portfolio of stocks. And it's assumed that, and this follows from the assumption that the only people who gain from privately owned means of production are the owners. And therefore, they're the only people interested in lower taxes on the income derived from the means of production. And you'll find a variant of this, I'm sure, a week from tomorrow night when the media start reporting the election returns. Almost always there are some surprise results in given districts, certainly in congressional districts. And you may encounter perhaps a free enterprise candidate who does well in a blue-collar district. And if this happens, I think the media will be surprised. Conversely, if a left-wing candidate does well in an upper-class district, they'll also be surprised. Why will they be surprised?
They would assume that in the blue collar that they would be have a tendency more towards thinking that, you know, that the wealth should be spread out.
Yeah, they assume, the assumption is that if you're a non-owner of the means of production, you not only have nothing to gain by policies that enrich the owners of the means of production, but your gain would be precisely the opposite. Your gain consists in policies of redistribution in one form or another, raising the taxes on the rich. And you hear this really all over the place. If you look at the debate on taxes, the president, for example, is repeatedly criticized because so much of the tax cuts that were put through at his initiative favored the highest income earners in the country. And it's assumed, well, that's great for the top 1% of the population or whatever, but it's of no significance of any kind to the rest of the population, except perhaps to deprive them of funds available for projects that would be a benefit to them, perhaps like greater Medicare spending or greater government funding of education or whatever. It's assumed that if the owners of the means of production keep more of their incomes, that is just a benefit to them and nobody else. Nobody has any kind of stake in what benefits privately owned means of production or their owners, but the owners. And there was yet another variant of this back in the days of the Vietnam War, for example, or the general Cold War. It was thought that if we want to stop the spread of communism around the world in countries such as Vietnam, what was required is to create more capitalists. Why would you supposedly need more capitalists in order to fight the spread of communism? Because it's assumed that the only people who have an interest in opposing communism are the capitalist owners of the means of production, that the non-owners, that their self-interest has nothing to do with capitalism, that indeed it would be served more by socialism or communism. And I think this is how most people are seeing it. They think only the owners of the means of production benefit from the means of production. The non-owners derive no benefit from other people's means of production. Their benefit would begin only on the day that they became the owners. That's what underlies the popularity of redistributionism and, in the major measure, the popularity of socialism. Now, what I want to point out, and now this is point two, that this prevailing view ignores the existence of the division of labor. It would be a reasonable point of view in the ages prior to the development of the division of labor. If you were looking at conditions centuries ago, or at conditions in a third world economy, if you ask in a society where people are living essentially as self-sufficient farmers, if you go and you look at a farmer's field in such conditions and you ask, who is it who benefits from this field? Who benefits from the oxen and the plow or whatever, and whatever barn or other buildings are on this farm? Who would be the physical beneficiaries?
The owner
and his family. The farm produces food. The owner and his family get to eat the food. So they benefit from those means of production. That's the way it is with consumers' goods. If you ask, who benefits from your personal automobile? Well, it's you and your family. Who benefits from the clothes you own? You and your family. Well, in a non-division of labor economy, the same would be true of the means of production. They'd be employed in producing for the personal use of the owners. But now notice what a difference is made if we have a division of labor society and a market economy. In such a society, what are the means of production producing for? Who gets the food that is grown on a given farm in our society? We have farms in Nebraska, Iowa, elsewhere. Who is getting the benefit of the crops? Who is eating the food that comes from those crops in our economy? The general consuming public. How much of their grain or whatever do the farmers in Iowa and Nebraska consume? An insignificant fraction. They're producing overwhelmingly for the market, and the overwhelming beneficiaries of their fields, their equipment, their barns, all of their means of production are the buyers of the ultimate products. Now, the same is also true of the General Motors automobile factories. Who is getting the benefit of the cars coming out of the factories? How many of those cars are going into the possession of the stockholders or bondholders of GM? An insignificant fraction. Who is getting the overwhelming bulk of the cars coming out of GM's factories? The general consuming public, the buyers. The people who get the benefit of the means of production are the buyers. In a division of labor economy, the means of production are employed in producing products for the market. The physical benefit of the means of production is going to the buyers of the products, not the owners of the means of production. The physical benefit of the means of production goes to the buyers of the products. And the buyers of the products need not be owners of the means of production at all. You don't have to own a single share of GM stock or a single one of its bonds in order to get the benefit of its means of production. You get that benefit when you buy one of its automobiles. And if we look at the situation this way, and we broaden the issue from a given company to the economy as a whole, who is getting, suppose we look at all of the stockholders and bondholders taken together, and we look at all of the consumption that's taking place out of dividends and interest income, and we compare it to the consumption taking place out of wage and salary income. What do you think represents the far greater part of the source of consumption?
Wages and salaries.
It's wages and salaries. The national income statistics typically show that something like 3/4 of the national income is wages and salaries, and 1/4 may be profit and interest. Well, a huge proportion of profit and interest, if we put aside taxes, the taxes take a huge proportion in the first place. Taxes probably take well over half. But typically, with or without the taxes, something at least on the order of half or more of profits and interest would be saved and reinvested. Now, it might very well be, I think, that maybe 60% of profits and interest could be saved and reinvested. There's a lot of saving and reinvestment that takes place on the part of corporations that earn the profits, and then to the extent that they pay out dividends, and those dividends are going to high-income individuals, what do these high-income individuals typically do with a major chunk of the profit and interest that they may receive? They save and reinvest it. Well, if you keep all this in mind, I think it is very likely that of the total consumption going on in the economy, perhaps no more than about 10% is taking place on the part of people who have significant profit or interest income. That the significant capitalists, let's say those with a capital greater than $2 million, that their consumption probably amounts to no more than about 10% of total consumption in the economy. You can read a lot more about it in terms of newspaper coverage. You might have big spreads on a luxurious mansion, a beautiful private yacht, a private jet. But how many people have such things? Suppose we add up all of the great mansions, maybe there's a few dozen of them, and we put them aside, all of the tens of millions of ordinary homes. What do you think bulks as substantial, as significant? It's the ordinary homes. Suppose we apply the same thing to the food that's consumed, the automobiles that are owned and driven, the television sets, the telephones, the refrigerators, the fraction of the clothing that is owned. Who are the overwhelming consumers of virtually everything?
The general population.
That's the general population. And the far and away the major source of consumption, I would estimate something on the order of 90% or so, is wages and salaries, or the profits and interest of relatively small businesses whose work does not profoundly differ from that of wage and salary earners. Now, the way I put it in point A here, the benefit to the buyers of the products served by the means of production. If you can buy the products, you don't have to own the means of production. You already benefit them. You already benefit from them. You benefit in being able to buy the products from those who do own the means of production. And then there's a further point that we saw earlier in our discussion of the uniformity of profit principle, that it's the consumers who determine how the means of production are used. How do the ordinary consumers, in the last analysis, determine how the means of production are employed? Through their pattern of demand, the consumers, by their pattern of buying and abstention from buying, they're determining what products and industries are profitable and what are unprofitable. And then the owners of the means of production, in order to be profitable, have to produce the products that have sufficient demand, and they have to give up producing the products that lack a sufficient demand. So it's the consumers who are determining how the means of production owned by others are used. And this is in sharpest contrast to what goes on under socialism. Under socialism, you don't have any profit and loss incentives. The consumers are economically powerless. They have no power to change the course of production. Everything is in a state of shortage. If the consumers want more of something, it's the same as price controls. They have no way to make the price and profit go up. There is no one would get a profit under Bolshevik-type socialism. And they're not going to stop spending on something. They're glad to get anything rather than have to eat the money. Now, just think, if you think about what goes on in the company you work for, I'm sure you'll find people who are literally staying up late at nights thinking how they can improve what that company is doing, or at least the sphere that's under their control. They have the profit loss incentive to do this. That's a very powerful motivation. Under capitalism, you have businessmen staying up late at night thinking, how can they improve the breakfast cereal of the ordinary person? How can they improve the shoes that the ordinary person wears? Now, they're not doing it out of any love of the ordinary person. They're doing it out of the love of the profit they can make if they can induce more people to buy their products. But that's what gets them to serve the market. Under socialism, in contrast, the government officials have no incentive to serve anybody. And you can think of it right here. You can have terrible conditions going on. I think of the New York subway system. People jammed in like sardines. Sometimes you can't even move your arm in the rush hour because people are wedged in all around you. Do you think the mayor and city council of New York are staying up late at night worrying how are they going to fix this? Why should they be bothered? Do you think that anyone in Congress is staying up late, awake late at night, thinking, how can they fix the medical situation? What can they do so that it doesn't cost $2,000 a night to stay at a hospital? It doesn't cost $30 for a Tylenol capsule. They might get concerned if that became a hot issue in an election, but then after the election, what happens? And it's not likely to be that hot an issue, and even if it is, when you have an election, how often is an election decided on a single issue? These things get lost in the shuffle. And if you have something that applies to a local area, to a relatively small number of people, it'll never even appear on the radar screen. Now, I make a reference here in point B, the benefit of wage earners from the demand for labor. The demand for labor depends on capital. The great bulk of wages in the economy are paid out of capital, and the larger the capitals that have been accumulated, the greater is the demand for labor. And so non-owners of the means of production benefit from other people's means of production insofar as those other people's means of production are the foundation of the demand for their labor. Just ask yourself, where would you rather be looking for a job? In a country that has a handful of poor, starving capitalists, or in a country with a large number of very wealthy capitalists? Where do you think you'd have a better chance of getting a good paying job? In a country with a lot of large, wealthy capitalists. It's very desirable to have huge firms like GM and IBM and the others with billions or tens of billions of dollars of capital today. They need labor to operate their means of production, produce the products, and the more and bigger the capitalists are, the greater will be the demand for labor, and other things being equal, the higher are wage rates. So to put all this together, there is a twofold general benefit from other people's means of production. The non-owners benefit from other people's means of production insofar as those means of production are the source of the supply of the products that the non-owners buy. And they benefit from other people's means of production insofar as those means of production are the source of the demand for the labor that the non-owners sell. So the non-owners are buying products and selling labor, and greater the capital of other people, the greater the volume of privately owned means of production producing for the market, the larger is the supply of products for the non-owners to buy, and the greater the demand for the labor of the non-owners to sell. That's a twofold general benefit from other people's means of production. And it's not all that difficult to see this, but amazingly, general discussion is carried on in complete and total ignorance of it. And it goes even further, point three, the increasing general benefit from private capital. It's not only that there's an immense benefit, but that the benefit tends to become greater as time goes on. And we've already seen a very major reason for this, namely profit and loss incentives and the freedom of competition and individual initiative. Just think, what is the way to make an exceptional rate of profit? What are the main ways to make an exceptional rate of profit? Yes, Ms. Fox.
Staying ahead of the technology.
To be a leader in the introduction of better products or more efficient methods of producing existing products, right? That's how to make an exceptional rate of profit. But then what happens, once you are making this exceptional rate of profit, and others see that you are, and quite possibly they're earning lower profits or losses because they're losing in competition to you, what then will others be seeking to do? They'll be attempting to duplicate what you're doing, and once they succeed on any scale in doing that, what happens to the special profit you were making? It's eliminated. And then who ends up with the whole benefit of the improvement? whether in quality of product or reduction in cost. The general consuming public, they get a better product and or a less expensive product. And then to make an exceptional profit, there have to be further innovations. And if someone wants to make an exceptional profit over a protracted period of time, he'll generally need to introduce a series of innovations. And competition is constantly operating to eliminate these special profits. And the dynamic is that the general buying public is getting more and more. We had a discussion of this, and I think when we had it, I may have omitted to point out a substantial illustration of this. I did point out that the implication is that we should expect prices of consumers' goods to be progressively falling. We don't observe that very often. We observe, rather, prices rising. I think I explained what reconciles the implication with the observation. But look at it in a somewhat different way. Suppose you stop to calculate prices not in terms of depreciating paper dollars, but in terms of the hours and minutes of labor that people have to put in on a job in order to earn the money to buy goods. Well, stop me if I did go into this. Suppose we compare today with the situation of 100 years ago. 100 years ago, people were working perhaps 60 hours a week. And what were they able to obtain as the result of having worked 60 hours a week? The average standard of living of 1904, the average wage earner standard of living of 1904, which obviously didn't include a refrigerator, a television set, an automobile, a computer. It didn't include any of many of the things that we take for granted. And the things that they did have that we still have, they were typically getting much less and in poorer quality. The average wardrobe was much smaller. The diet was poorer. The amount of living space was less. So just about everything was a lot less. Now today, the average worker works a 40-hour week, and he gets a radically higher standard of living, a standard of living that includes all of these goods that we see around us. And if we put a number on today's standard of living compared with that of 1904, I think 10 is not an unreasonable multiple. If it's the case that the standard of living of the average wage earner in 2004 is 10 times that of 1904, and he gets it by working two-thirds as much, well, what's implied about the labor hours cost of a standard of living equal to that of 1904? It's dropped tremendously. In the numerator, in 1904, we had 60 hours of labor. In the denominator, we had one, the standard of living of 1904. Today, in the numerator, we'd have 40 hours of labor, and in the denominator, 10 times the standard of living of 1904. So if we have a numerator of two-thirds and a denominator of 10, what is that reduced to? That would indicate the average labor hour price of 1904 standard of living, or the equivalent of 1904 standard of living. It would mean it's obtained for 6 2/3% of the labor. The real price of the 1904 standard of living has fallen 93 1/3%. Now, why has it risen in paper dollars? Well, because the dollars have gotten so much cheaper. They've gotten cheaper much faster than the profit motive has been able to succeed in making the great mass of goods cheaper. And I'm sure I gave you an example illustrating how this principle operates. Now, also, notice when you have capitalism, you have the freedom of competition, and to the extent that economic freedom exists, it means that everyone is legally free to enter any branch of industry. Now, we have some significant barriers in the way of that, but they're all violations of private property rights and economic freedom. But to the extent that we have it, and anyone is legally free to enter any branch of industry. What this means is that if anyone anywhere comes up with a better idea as to how to do something, he's legally free to try to do it. And how many chances are there for raising the necessary capital? I suppose you can think of some project that requires, let's say, $10 million in order to put your project into practice on some scale, on some kind of demonstration scale. Well, how many possible chances of financing do you have?
What?
Well, certainly any individual who has $10 million or more, that's one possible chance, or any combination of individuals who between them have $10 million. So what this means is you have an enormous number of possible chances for a new idea obtaining financing. You can be rejected time and time again. You can knock on 100 doors, have them slammed in your face. You only need one to connect. And if you find that one, then your idea has a chance. And the people who will provide the capital, they have an incentive. You will be sharing the high profits of the innovation with them. And that provides an incentive to them. In contrast, under socialism, how many chances for new ideas being tried do you have? If the system were working as its authors project, you'd have one chance. Now, in practice, you might have a somewhat larger number because there are separate centers of power under socialism, but you wouldn't have very many chances. And whatever chances you might have, what incentive is there to introduce innovations that are a benefit to the average person? Virtually nothing. There's very little chance for new ideas being tried. Virtually no chance for ideas being tried that would merely be a benefit to the average person. The implementation of such ideas would create a lot of disturbance. It won't profit the people who would be responsible for introducing it. They'd just be arousing negative results, not gaining anything personally. So the only kind of innovations that are likely to be adopted under socialism are those which mesh with the values of the rulers. If you could deliver to the old Soviet Union's government a more powerful weapon of mass destruction, a more effective means of spying on the citizenry, that they'd be interested in. Something that would bring prestige to the regime, that they'd be interested in. Any improvement or innovation is essentially limited to the kinds that result in power and prestige for the rulers. They're not of benefit to the average person. Now, I make a related point under B. The gains to the non-owners are greater the more the property rights of the capitalists are respected. We have greater gains the more the property rights of the capitalists are respected. And that is true for a number of reasons. One is, what is the strength of the profit loss incentive to the extent that you keep a larger share of the profits that you're making? Yes, Ms. Holmes.
You'll reinvest them.
Well, there's the reinvestment element. That's certainly true, too. But what about the sheer incentive to go and earn the profits in the first place? Compare different alternatives. In one arrangement, you pay 10% of your profit as a tax. In another, 25%. In a third, 50%. In a fourth, 90%. In a fifth, 0%. Which would represent the most powerful incentive to earn greater profits? With zero tax on the profits. The heavier the taxation of profits, the less the incentive to earn them. And then also, the incentive to give up loss-making ventures is reduced too. If you have a loss and your losses serve to reduce your taxable income, well, you're not bearing the full burden of the loss. You're just bearing the part of the loss that you would have been able to keep after taxes. It's a lesser loss. And what about to the extent that the taxes you're paying are being used to subsidize other less efficient methods of production? what does that imply about the rate of economic progress to the extent we have higher taxes on profits and to the extent that these taxes are being used to subsidize inefficient methods of production. What's implied for the standard of living and economic progress? It has to be negative. Now, very importantly, the point Ms. Fox alluded to the extent that the taxation on profits and also interest are lower, there'll be a very large proportion of additional saving and investment. Profit and interest income, especially when it's a high level of income, especially when it's earned as a high rate of return on capital, will tend to be very heavily saved and reinvested. What is the effect of greater saving and reinvestment on the standard of living of everybody? What's it do to the supply of means of production? It increases the supply of means of production. What's it do to the demand for labor? It increases the demand for labor. So to whatever extent we can reduce the kinds of taxes that will be heavily saved in reinvestment, the effect, heavily saved and reinvested, the effect is to increase the supply of means of production and to raise the demand for labor, both of which benefit everybody. Now, this has some direct bearing on the current tax debate. Usually one simply reads complaints. So much of the benefit of the tax cuts went to the top 1% of the taxpayers. And it's assumed, well, yeah, that's good for them, it benefits them, but it doesn't have any effect on anybody else. Well, what do you think the top 1% are likely doing with the greater part, the far greater part, of the reduced taxes that they pay? They're saving and reinvesting it. Now, if we have additional saving and investment, and that's operating to add to the economy, does that not benefit the average person in his capacity as a buyer of consumers' goods and a seller of labor?
Yes.
It certainly does. Now, the only problem is, and this is a serious issue, when you cut taxes but don't cut government spending, the effect is to enlarge the deficit. And then where does the government get the money to finance the deficit? Well, they could print it, or they borrow it. In recent times, they've been borrowing it mainly. But when they borrow it, what are they doing to the available supply of savings? Pardon me? They're reducing it. They're absorbing part of the pool of savings. There is less available for private businesses and private the mortgage market. It's going instead, those funds are going instead to finance the deficit. Now, it can even work out if you cut taxes that are very heavily saved, but you don't cut government spending, the effect can be perverse. You can end up with less available savings rather than more, even though the people who are paying the lower taxes are saving very, very heavily. And the reason I'm saying this, I'll illustrate it with this example. Imagine we have a tax cut of $100 billion occurring over some period of time. And this is going to people who save very, very heavily. And let's even assume they'll save 80% of the tax cut. They'll save and invest 80% of the reduction in what they have to pay in taxes. Well, that's terrific as far as it goes. It would be very, very positive. But if the government is continuing to spend the same amount of money and now has to go into the market and borrow the $100 billion that it no longer collects in taxes, what is its borrowing of $100 billion doing to the available supply of savings that remains for the private economy? Reducing it by how much? $100 billion. So if you have a tax cut that makes possible $80 billion being added in, but the $100 billion are being taken out to finance the deficit, that is a net loss. Well, what policy would you have to adopt to correct for this so that the tax cut would simply go in and increase the supply of saving and investment?
Increase Reduce government spending.
Reduce government spending. Cut the damn government spending by $100 billion, then cut taxes by the $100 billion, and we'd have $80 billion more of saving and investment. Then the policy would really work. But we have a halfway effort. It's popular to cut taxes, but the politicians want to avoid the uproar that would follow if you cut government spending. Now, there's something that could exist, that used to exist, which would compel them to cut government spending if they wanted to cut taxes. I wonder if anyone could guess what that would be. It's a it's something that applies to the kind of monetary system that we have. Pardon me?
Would it be the supply of money, like an actual gold standard?
Yeah, if we had a gold standard and the government lacked the ability to create money, then they could not afford to operate with deficits. See, if you don't have the ability to create money and you operate at deficits year after year, well, what happens to you or me if we keep charging more on our credit cards than we're repaying? Where will we end up if this is our continuing policy? We'll end up in bankruptcy. Now, the only reason that the government doesn't end up in bankruptcy by following the same policy is that it has the ability to create money. And you and I would not end up in bankruptcy either if we had that ability. If you maxed out all your credit cards, but you have a printing press in your basement, you can pay down the balances, and then maybe they'll increase your credit lines. Yes, Mr. Feldman.
At what limit does the government stop creating
money? At what limit does the government stop printing the money?
Yes.
Well, the only limit beyond which they can't is when the process has gone so far that people are dumping the government's money in the sewers, and it no longer will be accepted as money. Then the government has lost the power to create money.
So why don't they create as much as they need?
I mean,
why wouldn't the government create as much as needed?
As much as to achieve that? Well, they're not that blindly, stupidly reckless.
Well,
I mean, they could end up there, but
to get us out of these deficits.
Well, that would be a much worse evil than any deficits. I mean, if the money were destroyed, unless you have an alternative money to quickly take its place, then what can be the consequences?
No,
you can't exchange.
Pardon me?
You cannot exchange things.
You couldn't exchange. The whole division of labor would be threatened. The division of labor depends on the existence of money. And if we destroyed money without making it possible for people to quickly have a new money, we could destroy the whole modern world. Yes, Mr. Wilson.
Earlier you were referring to the reduction in taxes results in increased savings and reinvestment.
Yeah.
Are you equating savings and reinvestment as being equal?
They're essentially equal, yes.
Savings being additional supplies to the capital available for...
Yeah, okay. Yeah, saving and investment.
Because the way I see it a lot is that some of the... Where you see more of the mass of money coming in, not so much of the high dollar amounts, but in terms of the mode of money, it seems like a lot of it's hoarded and inefficiently saved rather than reinvested back into big companies.
Oh, you think a lot of...
Particularly when you're talking about, like... tax cuts.
Yeah.
What do you say about that?
You say your observation tells you that much saving is simply hoarded?
A lot. I would say a lot of it is, yeah. Like put in cash investments instead of,
Well, what do you mean by cash investment?
Like cash investments. Speaking of like money market funds, T-bills.
Okay, but now money market funds and T-bills, do you think that's hoarding? What does the money market do with the funds? If you put money, let's say you buy a CD or something, what does the financial institution do with the money you've paid for the CD or have deposited?
Well, they're paying you interest, but it just seems like it perpetuates.
Well, they're paying you interest, but what do they do? What do they do with the money?
They invest it.
They invest the money.
I understand that.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is, there's higher rates of return to be made as far as reinvesting goes.
Mm-hmm.
Say at a business level, if a business gets a tax cut, yeah, they would reinvest in R&D or something,
yeah,
which pays a higher return,
yeah,
than would be, you know, a cash investment.
Right, but we're talking the kind of saving we've been talking about primarily is in connection with tax cuts on owners of means of production, tax cuts going to the top 1% of the taxpayers. They're not putting money in mutual funds, are they?
I'm not talking about them. I'm talking about Mr. and Mrs. Joe the taxpayer.
Right. Now, but we're talking about tax cuts that go, tax cuts of a kind that will be very heavily saved and reinvested. The tax cuts for the benefit of the average person will not be so heavily saved and reinvested. They'll probably be almost entirely consumed.
Well, that's for like the masses, but I'm talking about like that between 5% and 10%, you know, group of wealth, and it just seems like a lot of them are putting their money in CDs and things, and I don't see that as an efficient way of saving.
Well, it's the people who are putting their money in CDs, they do it because they think it's the best alternative open to them in their circumstances. And the institutions that are selling the CDs, they have more funds available to lend. The money is not being hoarded, it's being lent and invested. And there is no net saving at the level of the economy as a whole that is not invested. And a simple illustration is, at this moment, each of us has a certain amount of cash in our wallet or purse, and it adds up to some definite totality. Now imagine that we locked the door, and for the next half hour, we played that we were a self-sufficient economic system. And different people will make different products, and they'll sell them to other members of the class, they'll buy other things, and so on. Now, to the extent that any saving took place on the part of the class as a whole, it would have to show up in an increase in assets other than cash. There would be no way that the class could accumulate savings in the form of cash. A given individual member of the class could accumulate savings in the form of cash, but to whatever extent any member of the class ended the period with more cash than he began, what would be implied about the cash holdings of other members of the class? They would have to be equivalently decreased. And so if the class as a whole were to have more savings at the end of the period than it began, it would have to take the form of an increase in the value of assets other than cash. That would be investment. In an economy as a whole, there is no such thing as saving in the form of hoarding. Whatever saving occurs in the economy as a whole takes place in the form of an increase in the value of assets other than cash, with one very limited exception, and that is the increase in the quantity of money. To the extent that there is more money at the end of the period than at the beginning, that additional money may be held in cash holdings, but it's only to that extent that there is saving in the form of increase in cash holdings for the system as a whole. Everything else is in the form of assets other than cash. Now, when you have a greater saving and investment, the savings are spent in buying capital goods, unless, assuming they're not going to finance the government's deficit. Assume we had a balanced budget and reduced government spending, reduced taxes of a kind that would be saved and invested. The demand for capital goods would rise. The demand for consumers' goods coming from the government and the people the government was giving money to, that would fall. We have a greater demand for capital goods and a reduced demand for consumers' goods. How would that affect the relative production of capital goods and consumers' goods? Now, I'm giving you an example. I'm saying people are saving and investing more, buying more capital goods. The government is consuming less. So I would think the obvious answer is the demand for capital goods rises, the demand for consumers' goods falls. Now, that might be a difficult conclusion for many people to accept. You wonder, how can it be that if the demand for consumers' goods falls, the demand for capital goods can rise? Well, what can happen, of course, is You see, when the demand for any particular industry falls, what will typically happen to its demand for capital goods and labor? That will fall too. But when we're dealing with the economy as a whole, there is no fixed ratio of demand for capital goods to demand for consumers' goods. You could have the same demand for consumers' goods supporting a widely varying demand for capital goods. Or we could have a much smaller demand for consumers' goods going with a larger demand for capital goods. Now, how would such a thing be possible? Let's suppose in the entire economic system, the total demand for capital goods and consumers' goods combined is fixed. Let's call it 1,000 units of money. Each unit of money can represent $100 billion. The total expenditure to buy capital goods and consumers' goods together is fixed. I would say it is conceivable that at one extreme, you might have a system in which there's 1,000 units of demand for consumers' goods and no demand at all for capital goods. What would produce such a result? If those who are selling for the 1,000 units of expenditure, if they entirely consumed the proceeds, if they took in every unit of money and turned around and consumed it, there'd be zero saving, zero demand for capital goods, zero demand for labor. You have just demand for consumers' goods. Alternatively, you could have a system with 900 demand for consumers' goods, 100 demand for capital goods, 500 demand for consumers' goods, 500 demand for capital goods, or even 100 demand for consumers' goods, 900 demand for capital goods. Now, how would such a thing work? Well, if we had only 100 of demand for consumers' goods, do you think 900 would be spent to produce those 100 of consumer goods? Do you think firms would be spending 900 to buy means of production to produce products for which they would only receive 100?
Probably
not. No, but now just think, if the demand for consumers' goods was 100 and the demand for capital goods 900, and that's what we're looking forward to, we expect to take in 100 in the sale of consumers' goods. But next year, we expect to take in also 900 in the sale of capital goods. How will the 900 of demand for capital goods this year be deployed? Here we are. We have two basic products. We have consumers' goods, and we have capital goods. The demand for consumers' goods that we're going to take in is 100. The demand for capital goods that we'll take in is 900. Currently, we're making 900 of demand for capital goods. How will this 900 be related to the prospective 100 and 900? We won't spend the whole 900 to produce 100 worth of consumers' goods and nothing to produce 900 worth of capital goods, would we? What would we be more likely to do? Well, how about, for example, spending 90 to produce next year's 100 worth of consumers' goods and 810 to produce next year's 900 worth of capital goods? See, to the extent that the demand for capital goods grows, the portion of the capital goods in the economy used to produce capital goods grows. It's not true that the only thing that we produce is consumers' goods. We also produce capital goods. Now, ultimately, the ultimate end product is consumers' goods, but that can take place under different circumstances. We could have an arrangement where we have 1,000 of demand for consumers' goods, we spend nothing at all to produce them. Or we could have 900 of demand for consumers' goods, 100 demand for capital goods, in which we spend 90 to produce the consumers' goods and 10 to produce the capital goods. Or we'd have a different arrangement, the one I described a moment ago. We spend 90 to produce the 100 of demand for consumers' goods and 810 to produce the capital goods. Now, of the capital goods that would be produced, what would be done with those capital goods? 810 are producing 900 worth of capital goods. In the following year, when those capital goods become available, how will they have to be used? Well, 90 will be used to produce the consumer's goods of the year after. So if we look at it a little further, what we'd have in this situation is, with these 900 of capital goods, we'd have 90 producing the consumer's goods of next year, 81 producing 90 of capital goods for next year, which the year after would produce 100 of consumer's goods. We'd have 72.10 of capital goods producing 81 of capital goods next year, which next year would produce 90 of capital goods for the year after, which the year after that would produce 100 of consumer's goods. Ultimately, we'd still be producing consumer's goods, but it would take a longer time. We'd have what is called a longer period of production. The more capital we have, the more long range the productive process is, and the more productive it is. So we can certainly have an arrangement whereby there is a reduction in demand for consumers' goods and a rise in demand for capital goods. What that would mean is that at each stage of production, each product would be the product of more previously produced means of production. There would be more labor and capital goods produced in the past going into the production of the product coming available in the future. I'll give you a last quick analogy to this. You've seen sets of luggage, I'm sure. You have the biggest piece perhaps is a four-suiter, then there's a three-suiter, a two-suiter, maybe a handbag or whatever. And each smaller piece could fit into the larger piece, right? All right, now just consider if we have a limited amount of material, and we could use this, the limited amount of material to make one very large piece. Let's say one six-suiter. That would be the counterpart of consumption. If that's what we did, would we have any material remaining to produce the other pieces? No. Now, to the extent that we want to have more material to produce other pieces, what do we have to do to this, the amount of material we employ in this largest piece? Pardon me?
Just reduce the example.
We have to reduce it. Now, isn't it possible? Wouldn't we be able to have more pieces fitting in, a larger number of separate pieces, but to get them, we have to make the biggest piece smaller. We have to make the biggest piece smaller in order to have more material available to make the further pieces, which can then all fit in one into the other, and then finally into the biggest remaining piece. Well, that's analogous to a reduction in the demand for consumers' goods and a rise in the demand for capital goods. When we say a reduction in consumers' goods makes possible a rise in demand for capital goods, we're not saying that we're simply reducing the biggest piece, and then we're going to have one remaining piece that must all by itself fit into that smaller big piece. We'd have to have a series of lesser pieces, one of which would fit into the other, and they would all ultimately fit into the biggest piece. That's how it works when there's a reduction in demand for consumers' goods and a rise in demand for capital goods. Now, with this, the tremendous advantage would be if we have a greater concentration on the production of capital goods, what is almost certainly going to happen to the physical supply of capital goods?
Increase.
It'll increase. And what does that do to our general ability to produce both capital goods and consumers' goods?
Increases.
We can then produce more of both. And if we have technological progress going on, we can be producing more of both year after year. And what will be the effect then on the average standard of living? It'll be progressively improving. This is the result of a policy of cutting government consumption and increasing the demand for capital goods. By reducing the taxes that are most heavily at the expense of saving and investment. That's the place to start. If we want to have the economy growing and progressing, we need to have more capital accumulation. And to have more capital accumulation, we need more saving and investment. And a major way to get that is to cut government spending and cut the taxes that fall on saving and investment. And a leading example of such a tax is the top brackets of the personal income tax. Now, also, I make reference here in point B to the more efficient production of capital goods, the more efficient production of capital goods. To the extent that the property rights of businessmen and capitalists are respected, and not only are their taxes reduced, but also the burden of general regulation, to the extent that that is reduced, and production is allowed to become more efficient, well, what does greater efficiency imply in terms of how much output you can get with the same means of production?
More.
You should get more output with the same means of production. Let's take some simple elementary examples. Suppose we have a farmer, and this farmer, his essential capital good is his supply of seed. And he uses up one bushel of seed in producing his crop. Now, where does the farmer get replacement seed? A self-sufficient farmer, where does he get replacement seed?
From his crop.
Now, in one set of circumstances, suppose our farmer is only able to get two bushels of crop for one bushel of seed that he uses up in the planting. What fraction of his output does he need to save and reinvest in order to have the same supply of seed next year?
50%.
Okay. Suppose our farmer could somehow become more efficient, and instead of getting two bushels of crop from one bushel of seed, suppose he could get four bushels of crop. Then what fraction of his larger crop would be required to replace his seed?
25%.
Only 25%. But now suppose that he continued to save and invest the old percentage, 50%. Now he'd have substantial capital accumulation. Well, the implication is that to the extent that we can make production more efficient, we are able to produce not only more consumers' goods, but also more capital goods with the same means of production. It makes capital accumulation easier. And deregulation would achieve exactly this. To give you some leading examples, we have all kinds of environmental regulations of very questionable benefit that have a major impact on additional required investment. For example, take these requirements that all of the gas stations rip up their old storage tanks and replace them with super leak-proof tanks. Now, this is a substantial additional investment. Does it enable the service stations to service any larger number of cars? No. Now, if you require more capital to achieve the same result, what is implied about how much overall result you can achieve with the same capital? Do you produce less with the same capital if you require more capital to produce the same? And the same capital then produces less. Well, these regulations are a major way that we undercut our ability to produce not only consumers' goods, but also capital goods. To the extent that labor unions prevent the introduction of improved methods of production, that's serving to hold down the ability to produce more capital goods, too. To the extent that mergers are prohibited, which would improve efficiency, that's undercutting capital formation. Anytime we have any regulations that are adding to costs means essentially we're requiring more factors of production to achieve the same result. When we require that things be undertaken at a higher cost, we're requiring that more factors of production be used to achieve the same results. And the accompaniment of that is we achieve less results with the same factors of production. And part of the less results are less capital goods. Now, the supply of capital goods is vital because the supply of capital goods is what determines the productivity of labor. What labor depends on is the plant and equipment available, the previously produced materials and so forth. All of this determines what the average worker is able to produce. And what the average worker is able to produce, that is what determines the supply of products available for people to buy. Well, we had a freer economy with less government spending and lower taxes, and much less government regulation. We'd have a higher proportion of saving and investment. We'd have greater efficiency of production. We'd have more rapid capital accumulation and a more rapid rise in the productivity of labor and general standard of living. Now, I have a reference here in point four, the special benefits of private ownership of the means of production, to the owners of the means of production. Now, I'll tell you, I almost always ask a question on the final about this subject, a multiple choice question, I think. And one of the choices is the special benefit of private ownership to the means of production is that they receive the profits and interest. That is not the special benefit. I know even though I've said it, many people aren't listening, but and they'll nevertheless choose that answer on the exam. To the extent that profits and interest are saved and invested, who is getting the benefit of the saved profits and interest? The general buying public. There'll be a greater demand for labor. There'll be a larger supply of means of production. To the extent that profits and interest are saved and invested, the beneficiaries are the same as the beneficiaries from the original capital. Imagine we have someone who has $10 million of capital. All right, who are the physical beneficiaries of the $10 million of capital? Okay, the people who are buying the products it helps to produce and the people who are selling the labor that it helps to employ. Now, suppose this capital earned a profit of $1 million. Now imagine that the entire profit were saved and reinvested. Now there's $11 million of capital. Who are the beneficiaries of the $11 million of capital? The exact same people, the general buying public and the wage earners. The special benefit of the ownership of the means of production, there are two special benefits. One of them is the extent to which the profit and interest is consumed, to the extent that it is not saved and invested, but personally consumed. So if we have someone who has $10 million of capital and he's earning $1 million of profit, if he personally consumes $200,000, that $200,000 goes to him and his family. But the $800,000 that he saves and invests, that's going to the buyers of the products and the sellers of the labor. So the special benefit that the owners of the means of production obtain by virtue of their ownership is not the profits and interest, but more correctly, the part of the profits and interest that are consumed. Now, truth be told, even that overstates matters somewhat. When you have people earning really very high incomes, part of their consumption will include the support of various activities that don't strictly entail their personal consumption. Suppose we have this example of someone earning $1 million of income and he's consuming $200,000. Well, I don't think it's impossible that this person, out of his $200,000 of consumption, might be making a $5,000 contribution to the Orange County Performing Arts Center or something comparable. And to the extent that he's doing something like that with the funds he consumes, who are the beneficiaries of that? A wider circle of people, not the general buying public, but certainly a significant further number of people. And the same would apply if he's contributing money to a university or a hospital or an orphanage or God knows what. And to the extent that there are people with very high incomes, their consumption will typically be only a relatively modest fraction of the incomes, and then also some significant fraction of their consumption is going to the support of such activities. The people who are earning $1 million are not eating $1 million worth of cheeseburgers. their actual physical consumption is really overstated by the funds they spend under the heading of consumption. Now, there is a further significant benefit that the owners of the means of production derive that the non-owners don't, and that is they have the very comforting knowledge that should they ever need to consume their capitals are available to them. So if you had $10 million, even though you would normally not touch the capital and you'd normally live well within the income, it's very, very comforting to know that should you ever need to touch the capital, it's there for you. And this is an important psychological benefit that the non-owners don't have. So I would say there are two special benefits that the private owners of the means of production derive that the non-owners don't. One is the extent to which they can consume out of the profits and interest, and then also the psychological potential, the psychological value of the potential of being able to consume the capital itself should they need to, which normally they will not. Okay, let me pause and ask if anyone has a question on this. We can deal with one at least before we take a break. So I'm curious to know if you think this is just off the wall, or this is some terrible fascistic point of view, or whatever.
Well, it makes sense. It's logical.
I think it's logical. I don't think it can be answered. But it's not something you hear. And I'm sure I'll find at the end of the term, hopefully not here, but if not in this class, in other classes, I'm sure, there'll be complaints that this is a one-sided class. It's not giving you the views that you've always heard for the last 16 years of your education. It's giving you a different view in one class. Shouldn't be allowed. Too much of this radically different view. Okay, let's take a break here. I'll see you all in 25 minutes.